I hope you enjoy this week's episode after a quick advertisement by our sponsor, NetSuite.
Best thing about a business is as it scales, you start being buried in manual work. At some point, cracks start to emerge. If this is you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. One, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all your KPIs. That is key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. That is exactly what I've done time after time for our businesses and when we were scaling at Automile. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely for free at netsuite.com/scale. That is netsuite.com/scale to get your own KPI checklist at netsuite.com/scale.
I have Brent Chidoba joining us. Brent, welcome to the Uncharted podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Poya.
We're excited to have you. Brent, you have an amazing background. For anybody that's listening to this that may not know who you are, can you give them a quick brief bio of who you are, both professionally, personally, and if you can throw in an interesting fact that maybe even folks that do know you may not know about you?
From a professional background, I started my career in finance, went to school, college in New York City, then went into a hedge fund in New York, then went into an investment banking, moved out to San Francisco to work on technology, M&A, and capital markets stuff. I worked for Piper Jaffray in investment banking, left banking to go into private equity, worked for Spectrum Equity Investors, who's an awesome growth equity firm, got to work with lots of really cool companies. One of those was a company called SurveyMonkey, which a lot of people know, but we worked to acquire the company from the founder it was in 2008. It was when we did the deal. I was so excited about the business and the CEO that we were bringing in that I asked if I could leave and go join SurveyMonkey. It was very small in terms of number of people, lots of users and revenue. So got to have my first operating experience working with an awesome CEO named Dave Goldberg, worked there for 7 years, eventually left as chief revenue officer and was helping manage the B2B side of the business, which was one of the growth engines for the future. We got to see everything from employee 14 up through maybe 750, 800 when I left, and left to go be COO and CFO at a company called PicMonkey that was also a Spectrum equity owned company. So I got to stay kind of within the family of the Spectrum folks, work with guys I knew to help a founder of PicMonkey along with a CTO that they had brought in as well. So got great experience there for a couple of years, got exposure to graphics and design, more of a creative space. For family reasons, my wife and I had our second child on the way. She wanted to move to the East Coast where she had more friends, family experience. So we moved to Charleston, South Carolina, which is not historically a tech hub, which is what I was used to in markets like San Francisco, Seattle, and New York. But I was able to find a cool role at Thrive Global in New York City, working with Arianna Huffington. So I was commuting up, which was tough with two little kids. Worked there for a year and then got the opportunity to go work with Tope Owatonna at Calendly, who was the founder of Calendly. Awesome business. I knew it, loved it. The business model was so similar to SurveyMonkey and stuff that I had seen that it was immediately attractive, running a lot of the kind of finance operations, sales ops, BI, a lot of the things that I was used to. I was there just over a year, and my wife and I had a third child on the way. At the time, I was commuting to Atlanta from Charleston. The commute needed to sort of end or change. Fortunately, that was right before the pandemic hit. Remote working became more normal, but I also got a call for a role at Biteable, which is a video creation platform. That's where I am today. Founded in Australia, the founders and board investors were looking for a CEO to help with go-to-market and just scaling up the business. It had gotten some initial traction. So it was a perfect fit, the role that I was looking for. And so jumped on board literally right before the pandemic. I started in February 20, and we were already remote. We had a bunch of people in Australia, a lot scattered throughout the US and Europe and Canada. Took on that role 4 years ago, and it's been really fun. It's been challenging. It's a super competitive market, more than I've ever faced. We are not the leader in the space. I have three young boys, live in a little island right outside of Charleston, South Carolina. Played soccer growing up, so I do a lot of soccer coaching for little kids and spend my weekends chasing kids around and then chasing a team around the world. Right now, kind of running a bunch of different functions at the company since we're still pretty small. One fun fact is like just that I played soccer in college. I think it still shapes so much of building teams, thinking about teams.
As you were talking about SurveyMonkey, you started to smile. And one of the reasons you went there, it sounds like, was for the CEO, Dave Goldberg. And I've heard amazing things. What made Dave so good as a leader?
When I first met him, I didn't know his background. He just came across really smart and seemed to have this gravity of people around him. And I didn't totally understand it until I'd worked with him for a while, that there was everyone who had any experience with Dave, it was positive. They liked him for some reason, either because he had good advice, he opened their email and responded to it and helped them when he didn't need to. So I think a lot of it was the benevolence. He was incredibly smart and funny, and just down to earth. So I think that's where anybody who got to interact with him, he could tell you how to play poker and how he learned to do things and best ways to just see a lot of hands, all this kind of advice he would give on different things. He super passionate about music, founded a music startup in LA. And so would sing on car rides when we were going from San Francisco to from Palo Alto to San Francisco or going to see a Warriors game. And it was hilarious because he's down to earth. He's a CEO singing in a car because he's just passionate about a song. And then he'd tell you, you know, the history of kind of that band in a way that was kind of engaging, kind of liked mentoring people that were two steps behind him in their career, because he could see that was a big part of his job, was like helping talent get to the next level. It wasn't necessarily out of strategy. It was just, that was a good natured kind of part of what he did. He also grasped finance, investing. He was a consultant at Bain. So like just kind of really smart across the board. And so pretty much anybody could find something in common with him. So I think that's, you're just always going to hear a lot of good stories from people that came across him, because he just was the kind of guy that did good things for other people.
Amazing. You got to love people that no matter how successful they are, they don't forget importance of paying it forward. And it sounds like he resembled that. As you were talking, I'm not joking. Last week, I got a call from an Australian company that I had met. And the dude's like, hey, the CEO is leaving. Do you want to do this? You take over the US, I take over the rest of the world. And I'm just curious, in those moments, what's your framework?
One interesting piece of advice I got from a great executive recruiter when I was looking at roles, I was typically looking at COO and CEO roles when I was leaving SurveyMonkey and in roles after that. And what someone said is, you're going to see a lot of different things, but your first CEO job, there's going to be some problems. They're not going to hire you if they could get somebody better, because you've never done the job before. So if there's someone better, then they would have that role. So there's going to be some problems that other people couldn't fit. And so sometimes there's situations because of location, business model, specific industry stuff where it actually, there isn't anything problematic. At Biteable, I wouldn't say there's anything problematic, but that was an interesting lesson. It's like, you have to figure out what's the problem of why they would hire me for this job. And so I kind of looked at that, where you need to make sure that problem isn't one that you can't help, or that you're not specifically in a position to make go away. I look at the hardest things to deal with are a ton of competition. You can't make that go away. So if you're a niche player in a small space, you have to think you can really carve out your own niche, and that's big enough and interesting enough, and that you can excite people to come work for you in that space. The business model itself, you don't want to be in a dying space unless that's kind of underinvested in. So something like email, people have been saying email has been dying for 20 years and it's still around. There's still new cool companies being formed. So if there's an interesting perspective, a reason to grow. So I think making sure the diligence there, the people you work with, the ownership structure, if there's investors, like that's also pretty critical. That's who's calling a lot of the shots or has the rights to call a lot of the shots when there's disagreement, making sure you understand that dynamic. I would also say, as a former private equity person and someone who's cold called into companies for years, those relationships play out over time. And so if there's any link and relationship of trust to leadership, founders, investors, they're going to tell you the real story versus try to kind of cover up anything of what's going on there. So you have to decide how much can you figure out that you trust, and then you got to make the leap. Sometimes those leaps, you find your own way and you kind of trust yourself to go, you know, figure something out that you don't know.
When you go to a smaller company that's different than a Calendly, than a SurveyMonkey, where it's just a different ballgame, give some context. What changes and what becomes important?
You know, what's funny, when I went to PicMonkey from SurveyMonkey, I had only had experience inside of SurveyMonkey as a tech company. And it was kind of cool from day one in Silicon Valley, in part because maybe because of Dave Goldberg was involved. We had just taken an investment from a great firm. The investment was mostly a recapitalization. It had some magic on it. And then when I went to PicMonkey, it was a smaller business in Seattle, in a space that, you know, Adobe had pioneered decades earlier. And so photo editing was, I wouldn't say on the decline, but it was definitely on the way out relative to graphic design. And we weren't there yet. We didn't have mobile apps. So it had a really nice business, but it wasn't something people were talking about. It wasn't cutting edge. It wasn't doing new business models. It was consumer only. And I found that the people I used to shoot an email to say, hey, I'm going to be in New York, you want to meet up, were pretty slow to respond. And I was like, what's going on? Is it me? Is it the business? And I found over time when I went to Bitable too, a lot of my friends and investor friends reached out, congrats, would love to hear about this business, but it was in a space that was pretty saturated. There were some winners already. There was Canva, the 800-pound gorilla in graphic design, at least on the do-it-yourself space. That was interesting, is your phone calls come back a little bit slower. I recognized that pretty early. And I think that's something that you have to navigate, is how do you work your way out of that? How do you understand that that's going to happen? And your job is to position yourself as a business, figure out your niche. The thing that I think clicked the most for me, we raised a Series A about a year after I started. I brought in an investor named Cloud Apps Capital, a partner that runs the firm that I've known for over a decade. We've closed the funding, and this is peak kind of COVID time. Closed the funding. I took a series of long walks, just like take my dog for a walk middle of the day, wandering around my neighborhood, and what's going to push us through? What are the biggest problems? And positioning is what kind of finally clicked. I read a book from April Dunford called Obviously Awesome. Like, I know who our customers are that are different, why people like us that were unique. I was constantly and still am constantly talking to customers, but I realized to catalyze a shift in our team, in our business, we had to nail the positioning of why this mattered to the world, why we were a potential leader in the category versus someone else doing a thing that Canva, Microsoft, Adobe, and others were doing. Probably the most fun part of being a CEO is that's your job, is you have to look at like a really hard problem and figure out how do we get around it. That is literally what my job is to figure out how to catalyze my team to get through some obstacle.
The hardest part about this is like the execution, right? Like, you can come up with ideas or the strategy, but like executing is like literally where I would say separates the great companies from the good companies. What have you learned about that part? I think it's a different ballgame when you're at a SurveyMonkey and you can sometimes afford to miss it the first time and fix it the second time, but it's a different ballgame where you're a smaller company.
You make a really good point that the margin for error is a lot smaller when you're a second player, third player, fifth player in a market space. And when your capital is less, when your situation is different, the couple things that stick out the most to me are, first, when you're in an environment where you're always hiring, there's just natural feel that you raise funding so that you can go hire a lot of people to do all these new jobs, to take on these new things. I saw it at SurveyMonkey. We hired over 1,000 people while I was there. Obviously, there's some turnover in that as well. At Calendly, more than tripled in size in the first year that I was working there. And so a lot of what I was doing was helping find new office space, figure out new systems, help recruiting, scale up different systems and processes, add sales capacity, and figure out territory mapping and plans and stuff like that. You're always adding people, and adding people is the answer to solving problems. I didn't necessarily have that mentality, but part of it is like, okay, we've got to try new things. We took investment, so we need to grow faster or think of different ways to scale. Looking back, I would definitely do that differently in thinking through how far can you push yourself and your team until you absolutely know the exact role. And also, the less margin of error you have, the slower you have to add certain functions that are a risk. So adding a sales team, best practice might be to add 2 or 3 reps and then start thinking about a leader without any proof that your product actually has product market fit with an upmarket audience. You can't do that if you don't have the resources, or if you realize you might have to peel that back. You can't hire a handful of people and then 6 months later say, oh, didn't work, let's just fire them and move on. Like, that is incredibly disruptive to their lives, to your business, to the rest of the team. Unwinding decisions takes over a year. It doesn't happen immediately, even if you can execute it very quickly. I've met Jason Fried and read all the 37 Signals posts, and he's been doing a lot of this lately of just sort of the wisdom lessons. And he's always been a proponent of moving slow at the right pace for your business and doing certain things. And the way to grow is different based on what you're trying to get in terms of the outcome of your business. And so I think a lot of that stuff resonates with me a lot lately, going through the ups and downs of hiring and having to reduce team size and then having to reshift roles to focus on what matters most. But that's the first, is how do you use your resources and how do you think about staffing? The second, the most success we've had, is how do you figure out how to focus, drive like incredible focus in the whole company. Our company is product led. Everything revolves around the product. We don't have sales. We do very little marketing, but marketing is essential in creating content, exposing new features, products, launches to our existing customers. It is entirely driven by, does the product satisfy the need of our customers? And are we onboarding people effectively enough? Are we using good monetization triggers to get them into paid packages to retain? We have a challenge in our business model in that a lot of customers come in and they need one video. Subscription models are not great at one video. Customers expect things to be cheap. The alternatives for making a video is potentially using a consultant or someone who has design expertise are going to charge thousands of dollars for their time. Yet people expect tens or hundreds of dollars for a software tool. So fundamentally, that's a challenge. So you have to be really good at onboarding and effective at activation and that kind of stuff. So for us, what I found was, what's a way to get every single person in the company focused on basically one, two, or three things at a time? And so we've kind of evolved to focus on themes every 6 months, which they can last longer, typically not shorter. But if everyone's focused on activation, and we know that this is a challenge in our product, but every single person is thinking about is what I'm working on today or the projects I'm doing next quarter going to help our KPI for activation, that had some big unlock for us. Right now, our focus is on exposing and accelerating the content in our product and getting that to users, adding more content, making users find it easier to find and consume. We see huge initiatives can take place when you give everyone permission to focus on solving a certain problem. That gets harder the bigger your organization gets, the more goals you have. And so what I've found is any way that you can streamline down the goals and get everybody focused in the same direction, then you get, 100% of, if you hired 50 smart people, you get 50 smart people working on the same problem, you're going to get some pretty awesome results. It's really challenging to do, but when you can get it humming, it really works. Our team has been together for over 2 years, everyone that's worked at the company, since we haven't done a lot of hiring lately, and that makes it a lot easier too. So getting tenure, getting cultural buy-in is going to let you take on big projects and drive a lot of focus.
You nailed it. I think when you're small, you really have to know exactly what you're prioritizing, what you're doubling down. That's literally the secret power of going a little further. What have you found tactically to get there?
I've personally never succeeded with OKRs. I've read a lot of the literature on it. I'm probably not doing it right, but regardless, it hasn't worked for me. I had a conversation when I started at Bitable with a guy named David Politis. He was the founder and CEO of a company called BetterCloud. Awesome, like passionate product leader, business leader. I caught him at a really good time. I said, hey, how do you guys do goals? You seem to have everything under control. And he was just giving me advice. I just went through this OKR thing. I never bought into it. I had my CFO run an OKR process after getting advice from my investors or other folks. It's changed my life. Like everything is simpler. Like we have themes and focus areas that kind of ripple through the whole company. My job is to get the leadership bought in, get them to be talking that way, and then help push it down and just reinforce it. And he had a bunch of ways, and he gave me kind of their methodology of how they did things, the process. I was like, okay, there's something here if this guy is this passionate about it. So I kind of said, what's going to work for me with that? That's right. I use themes that I think are not wildly dissimilar, but every 6 months or every quarter, I sort of look at what are the most important, typically three things for our business. That what are the problems I see in our metrics? What are the competitive things we need to catch up on? Right now, speed and performance is one of those. How do we make the app faster? How do we address bugs or issues that have been nagging us for a while? As I mentioned, that sort of content, exposing content to our users and adding a few different formats of content, like those are big blockers for what we see with our users. And then we have to polish it. For us, it's this make it beautiful and make the application shine in a lot of the editor features that we've been working on for a long time. So it's kind of finishing and polish for that. So those are our focus areas right now. But the big way that works is you gotta get buy-in from your product, every kind of squad leader, functional leader. I like to share a lot of those things. As soon as I start thinking about it, get feedback, see if that kind of resonates with folks, and then get the buy-in so that if you're a product manager, a marketer, a designer, things that are going to show up on your roadmap to-do list are going to map back to that. And effectively, that's sort of similar to OKRs in that you're trying to get a cascading set of priorities down. I've found we're a fully remote organization. It's all about communication. You have to constantly be reinforcing these things. Otherwise, it's not going to stick. If I say, hey, these are the themes, and I don't talk about it again for 6 months, how's anybody going to remember that? That's not what they're thinking about every day. They're thinking about doing whatever their job is, whatever's going to help their team do better. So I write a weekly email. I typically do it in video these days. We have a video platform, so it would be foolish not to, but I'll record myself talking about the themes. I'll ask a team member to explain how they view the importance of a theme, package that up. But I send something every week in monthly all hands. I start, here's our mission, vision, values. Here's the themes. Here's why we're different than everybody else, what we're going for. So it's just constant communication and making sure everybody's on board. And if you see anything that's misaligned, like flag it, call it, make sure. And I think for us right now, we're in a good position where once that has been working, it's just pretty natural. I don't see a lot of projects get started or proposed that don't have anything to do with the core things, because I think our team understands that if they're working on this, then they can ask another team for support doing something, and they'll say, oh yes, that's awesome. That's exactly aligned. We can do something bigger together because that's part of a theme.
Do you leave any room for experimentation?
I would say typically no. I wouldn't carve out experimental time. I've definitely been in organizations and thought through, like, we should have 20% of our time toward wild bets and stuff like that. We might say, hey, we're behind in this area. Let's make that a theme. Come up with a bunch of creative approaches that can address this gap of us not falling behind. If you have themes that the company believes in and someone's got an idea that's outside of that, they'll find a way to connect it there. And I would love to hear the story of why this thing that doesn't seem connected is actually still all we're trying to do is solve problems in the business. And if the wild card ideas or 20% time is not solving a problem that we face now or expect to face, probably not a great use of time anyway. So I think there's probably enough wiggle room. And if someone feels passionate, that's something that's probably hard that maybe we could do better of or not, but making sure people, one of the things that I've told our product and engineering teams is, if you feel really passionate, it's going to be very easy to convince myself or head of finance to go do something, because we're going to get excited too if somebody else is sort of has a good reason and they can justify it.
Yeah, that's the magic, right? Getting them somehow to buy in and come to the table with their ideas. Because if it's their ideas, that becomes just 10x easier.
Well, totally.
Look, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you for coming on, for paying it forward. The one question we'd love to ask before we say our goodbyes is, if you could go back to any time, what's one piece of advice the wiser, older Brent would give his younger self?
As I look at my career today, a lot of it is driven by the relationships that you build. One is working with, putting yourself in an environment where there's going to be a bunch of awesome, smart people means you're going to have an awesome, smart network that you can continue to stay in touch with. I think being in a couple places where you're exposed to smart people, for me, a lot of that's the Spectrum Equity Group, giant network of people from SurveyMonkey, and then all the other places I've worked along the way as well. A lot of the people that worked for me are now doing amazing things in their own careers. And so I can tap them for help, advice, things that they've gotten exposure to. Building that network by being in awesome places that are going to just have a lot of great people around the orbit, and then keeping those connections, whatever it is, like just saying hi, congratulating folks as people age and have kids and grow up and move to different places, like keeping in touch of projects they're working on, all that kind of stuff. That goes a really long way, because you will need help, advice, ideas, recruiting assistance, all that kind of stuff.
That's literally my superpower. And I'll get very tactical. When there's someone you want to keep in touch with, that's great. Like, Brent, I'm going to start doing this with you. Like every 6 months, hey man, how are things going? How are the Carolinas? How are the soccer practices? Like you don't even have to keep in touch, like jumping on a call or text, but like just a quick little text, like, hey, how's the family? How's the move? I literally just had one with this person who's running GP at APAC. And he's like, oh, I just moved to Australia. It's freaking crazy. And I've met this person twice, but every 6 months we go back and forth.
I have a list in Apple Reminders that's just people, and it's ones I don't want to forget to touch base with, even if I had, just like you said, one or two interactions. Sometimes it's just sending a text to say all good, just to say hello.
100%. Brent, this has been magical. Thanks for coming on the show. For everybody listening, until next time, be well, be safe. We'll catch you on the next episode. And Brent, thanks once again.
Thank you.
Best thing about a business is, as it scales, you start being buried in manual work. At some point, cracks start to emerge. If this is you, you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all your KPIs. That is key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. That is exactly what I've done time after time for our businesses and when we were scaling at Automile. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely for free at netsuite.com/scale. That is netsuite.com/scale to get